You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role does race play in your life? Does it have any bearing on the assumptions you make about other people or that they make about you? And if you don't harbor any ill will toward people whose race or ethnicity is different from your own, why is the subject still so hard to discuss openly? My guests today have explored those questions in both their personal and their professional lives. Steve Blow and James Ragland are both columnists for the Dallas Morning News. Their four-part series, Talking Race, ran this month and remains available online at dallasnews.com. Guys, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
So you both said at the outset that you were not even pretending that you would be speaking for every person of your race. I'm wondering, though, if as you started getting into this, if that was harder than you expected.
Yes, in some ways it is, because I think anytime you're addressing sort of a larger audience, they're assuming that you're kind of speaking on behalf of all black people or representing kind of the black point of view. So I think I went to great lengths to make sure people understood in my responses that there were it was a complex issue and that there was it was impossible for either one of us to carry that sort of weight.
One of those things that I think that probably put pressure on you, James, is that while for some reason our society doesn't assume that all whites speak for the white point of view, somehow when it's an African-American speaking about race, we just assume that, I shouldn't say we, but there is the assumption that there's sort of a monolithic point of view.
And I think that's one of the burdens that we in the media have, too, in terms of when we're reporting stories or reporting about issues that may or may not involve race, that we represent sort of the broader spectrum of black folks that are out there. If you notice the way we handle ourselves sometimes, we sort of anoint leaders and we run to them consistently, and then we put ourselves in a position of criticizing those same leaders for some of the points of view they may have. I think that's a challenge that the media has in terms of dealing with people of color and dealing with diverse communities.
Steve, you started this with sort of an open letter to African Americans from you. And one of the things that you said was that white racism is now irrelevant. Can you talk about what you meant by that?
Well, I think we really do still, in the media and other places, pay too much attention to that. What really has become the fringe element. In fact, I was reading something just last night in one of the news magazines that, according to some polling, only 3-4% of whites in America consciously label themselves as racist, and you know they're not ashamed of it, that you know they're supremacists or whatever. Now, of course, there's the unconscious and subconscious views that are much deeper and broader and harder to measure. But as far as people who are just willing to say, yeah, you know, I think the white race is superior, I think, you know, blah blah blah, it really has become just this tiny fringe group. And yet I think we sort of in a way let our perceptions of that group drive a lot of the debate, when I think there is tremendous goodwill. I think that's the thing that I was so gratified by this, is that we really tapped into this earnest desire among people of all colors to move forward, to make progress. And that's where people are today.
James, does white racism feel irrelevant to you?
In some ways, it does, but I delineate it this way. Racism used to be defined as sort of an institutional thing, and that's really where I spend most of my time, looking at how institutions deal with different ethnicities. I pointed out the criminal justice system as a good example, because the criminal justice system is fraught with all sorts of problems as it relates to the treatment of poor people and the treatment of minority people. We've been preoccupied here in Dallas lately, for example, with the Innocence Project. And if you look at the defendants involved in a lot of those crimes, they're often poor, they're often minorities, and they often didn't get fair representation. So I look at it that way, as more of an institutional issue than individual biases and prejudices, which we all have.
And don't get me wrong. Yeah, I'm not saying just because I say those, you know, the overt racists have become irrelevant. That certainly doesn't mean to say that there's no work left to be done, or that we don't all have a lot of soul searching about, you know, remnants and unconscious and subconscious attitudes. But as far as just that, you know, that hardcore element that once, you know, really did sort of rule, you know, cities and governmental institutions and things like that, you know, that era is over and is not coming back.
It's over, but I think, Chris, what happens is we're all carrying a lot of baggage around still. So what I think, if you talk about that 3-4% that Steve alludes to, who we may see as still being fairly overtly racist, and everybody else thinks they're okay, if you get inside the heads of that other 95 or 96%, I think there's some preconceived notions. I think there's some stereotypes. I think we're sort of conditioned to see people a certain way. And I think that plays itself out in different ways, whether it's in supermarkets or when you go in shopping, for example, you hear the stories, and some of this can be substantiated about how maybe black shoppers are treated differently in terms of the clerk and the way she or he interacts with the shopper, for example. But some of that is the shoppers themselves, the black shoppers who are have that baggage where they feel like they're being looked at a different way.
Well, have you had to sort of recalibrate throughout your adult life? And I'll ask this of both of you. In other words, recalibrate so that you adjust your sensitivity to what might be racism as opposed to what might be just bad treatment by a clerk. In other words, when a lot of white people walk into a store, if someone's rude to them, their first thought is not usually that it's because of their race. But I would imagine that if you think there's a possibility that that's the reason why someone's rude to you, it would be hard to shake that.
You know, on an individual level, it's certainly easy for me to recalibrate and take a look at it differently. I think collectively, though, I think that's still a problem. I think that we're too often making a snap judgment and saying that's the reason that I was treated differently. That's the reason the clerk was mean to me. That's the reason I couldn't get help right away. So to that end, I think Steve is dead on when he starts talking about we need to kind of look at this problem a little bit differently and not blame racism for all our problems.
On the flip side of that, I was surprised by how many whites I heard from who played the race card, to use that term, who talked about going into stores and they said, you know, it was so obvious that this black clerk had no interest in really helping me. And as soon as I was out of line, she chatted or he chatted friendly with the black person behind me. This kind of cuts both ways. It's kind of funny that this, you know, the perceptions now run in both directions to some extent.
And yet there's some substantial stuff that we need to talk about. There was a study that was done recently, and I'm sorry I can't cite the source, but it was looking at how cab drivers were being tipped. And I believe this was in New York and maybe Washington. And black cab drivers were tipped far less often and far less money than white cab drivers. And they weren't tipped less just by white passengers or white customers. Black customers tipped them less, too. So that, you know, and the conclusion there, or one of the conclusions or observations you can make about that is that there's a tendency to sort of devalue, black humanity. And that's the stuff that's sort of ingrained in our society that we're sort of moving beyond. And you can look in the workforce, for example, and I made a reference to the extent to which women are devalued versus white males, or minorities are underpaid versus white males. There's something going on there. We can separate that and start looking at sort of skill sets and experiences and those sorts of things. But it's deeper than that. And it says something about the degree to which we put a value on a person's life and a person's worth based on race or based on color.
My guests are Steve Blow and James Ragland, both columnists for the Dallas Morning News. They wrote a series this month that is available online at dallasnews.com called Talking Race. The question of being tied into the past, I think, is a really interesting one because, and you sort of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Steve, but you sort of expressed this, that you feel like there was worse, really endemic, really open racism before. And as a person who doesn't hold racist attitudes today, you feel sort of disconnected from whatever ancestors there may be in the white community because that's not you, that's not how you feel. But it seems as though a lot of African Americans don't feel disconnected from the bad treatment that they received from your ancestors or other people's ancestors.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word disconnected because that is almost a denial of the past. And so I wouldn't use that word, but I would maybe say more forward looking. And I think maybe that's kind of what it comes down to. A lot of there are a lot of whites who definitely take that attitude. I began that my sort of open letter. We each wrote kind of an open letter to the other race, and that was a really interesting exercise.
They were kind of a cool parallel.
That was James's idea that we do that, and I must say it, you know, sort of stirred more deep thought and emotions and, you know, soul searching than I imagined. But I began that with two words. I said, "I'm sorry." And, man, that really hit a lot of white folks wrong. I heard from a lot of irate people who said, you know, what? First of all, sort of that speaking for everybody thing. They said, you know, we don't need you to apologize on behalf of the white race. And I tried to say, no, I'm speaking for myself.
Was it an apology or was it an expression of empathy?
Well, it was a little bit of both. You know, that's what I said to some people. Have you never said to somebody at a funeral, "I'm sorry," when you didn't cause the death. You know, I don't think we have to be directly responsible to say I'm sorry. And yet I have to recognize that, you know, I am part of the white legacy that is responsible for that. And as surely as we inherit the benefits of things our predecessors did well, we inherit the problems from the things they did wrong. And so, yeah, we have an obligation there. But so, no, I don't feel disconnected from it as much as just as we calibrate, you know, that so much of life is about a balance. And how much do you look back and how much do you look forward? And I guess as a white person, what I sense others saying is, you know, and Jeremiah Wright thing was such a good litmus test of this very thing is, you know, how much are we going to look back and how much are we going to look forward? Let's look forward a little bit more instead of, you know, sort of constantly picking at that scab.
And Chris, what's interesting about that, when we wrote those concluding pieces, Steve began his piece by saying, I apologize or I'm sorry for past grievances. And I began my piece by saying thank you to, and this seemed like sort of a kind of an awkward way of expressing it, but thank you to whites who were involved in all these wonderful efforts that were showing their true colors, I think, their humanity, whether it was Habitat for Humanity or AIDS relief programs in Sub-Saharan Africa and so forth. Now, I constructed it that way for a lot of reasons, but essentially, I didn't want the white people to be demonized because we're taking a look back and looking at slavery and looking at Jim Crowism, because the racism is so complex, and I think individually our lives are so complex that when we try to oversimplify it, we run into trouble. And so I wanted to begin it that way by saying the story is not that simple, you know, and the story of black people is not that simple. So you can't oversimplify the black story just being one of pathologies. We've had a lot of success as well. So let's take a broader view and a longer view of both of our experiences.
Well, that was a very interesting thing that came up as well. James, you wrote about the fact that you feel as though a lot of white people look at black Americans and say this is sort of this legacy of not being quite as high in education and testing and things like that. And you really, a lot of African Americans look at this as a collective success story. Look where we started and look where we are now.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you can obviously... There's no doubt that when you start looking at some of the troubling statistics and some of the, you know, whether it's imprisonment or in the area of education and healthcare, that blacks are disproportionately represented in those categories. And my point is that we need to look at some of the underlying reasons why. And I think history plays a role in that. So much of what we talk about as it relates to race really is sort of more socioeconomic. There's some cultural issues at play there. But when we just reduce it to – that's what I think the racists do. When we just reduce it to race and say, why are black people dropping out of school? Why are all the black people incarcerated? And we are beginning to explore, for example, the criminal justice system and how it handles blacks, I think we make a big mistake. This may be an area where Steve and I sort of differ to some end. You know, he made the point in one of his pieces saying if you want to do the time, don't do the crime. I agree with that 100%. But I cited, for example, an area where you look at, say, drug users. There was a reliable study that was done that said I think blacks made up like 13% of known drug users, but they represented more than a third of those who were arrested, about 55% of those who were convicted, and three-quarters of those who were incarcerated. Troubling statistics. And you have to ask yourself why that is.
We'll get a response to that from Steve Blow in just a minute. My guests are Steve Blow and James Ragland, who are columnists for the Dallas Morning News. We're discussing their series, Talking Race, which is available online at dallasnews.com. You can join our conversation by calling 1-
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Send an email to think@kera.org. Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. James Ragland is here. He's a columnist for the Dallas Morning News, as is Steve Blow. We are talking about their series Talking Race, which you can read online at dallasnews.com. You can join the conversation by calling...
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Send an email to think@kera.org. So James was talking before about his assessment of the disparities we see in the arrest rates and conviction rates of African Americans as opposed to other racial groups. And this is one of those areas where you sort of bridled at what he had to say.
Yeah, well, in my defense, he said, you know, that I said this thing, if you don't want to do the time, don't do the crime, that sort of thing. Well, let me point out, I was quoting Chris Rock in that little passage where, and I think that's a you know, who has this whole riff on, you know, if you think there are too many black people in prison, then don't do a crime, you know. And there's kind of a basic sort of common sense thing there that needs to be said that I think leaves a lot of white folks frustrated. And that is, you know, I think there are a lot of whites are willing to talk about and think about, you know, institutional racism and how things are unfair, how the sentencing standards for crack cocaine were so different than powder cocaine. You know, white folks were open to that. But I also think there's an expectation that, hey, you know, let's also talk about the self-inflicted part of this, the personal responsibility aspect of this. And I think there's a sense that especially the leadership of the black community is just not willing to go there. I know it gets discussed in the black barbershops and, you know, when blacks get together. But the leaders won't go there, and I think there's kind of a thing in the black community, James and I have talked about this, of airing your dirty laundry. And I know black reporters come under a lot of criticism if they write a story that gets into, you know, aspects of this, of, you know, of how there's this sort of thing where kids can be taunted for acting white if they get good grades in a you know, predominantly black culture or school. One of our reporters wrote about that several years ago and took incredible grief from the black community because it was, how dare you air our dirty laundry? You know, we can talk about that, but don't you dare talk about it in the larger culture. And I just think it's time to move these discussions out into the larger culture. I think it's a healthy thing for everybody.
Let's talk about that for a minute. Even the question of, you know, most of my career was spent as a television reporter, which is a different story than print. But if there was a black story, the station would work very hard to send a black reporter out there. And I don't think anybody thinks about it when a crime happens in a white family, making sure that the reporter who said happens to be white. What is that something that troubles you, James? Is it something that just makes sense to you?
You know, in some respects, it makes sense. It's almost like if you've got a story in the Latino community and if there's a language or cultural issue there and you want somebody who can more readily identify with that culture or that community, it makes sense at some level. But I'm personally of the mind that you should have people who are just prepared to kind of go out and cover the city, you know, regardless of the area that you're dispatching them to. But that doesn't bother me. What bothers me, those are just the surface things. What bothers me is the degree to which there are still so many American newsrooms that don't have people of color in them at all. That's when stories aren't told. It's not that stories aren't told accurately or truthfully. They just aren't being told at all. And I think that's quite bothersome. You think about, that's why I talk about history matters. You think about American newsrooms and just 4 decades ago, so many American mainstream American newsrooms had no people of color writing about the black experience in America. My own paper was an example of that. I'm so proud of the steps, the progress this paper has made over the last 27, 28, 30 years. But you look back prior to that, and what were the stories being written about Oak Cliff or South Dallas or about the black experience here? You didn't get an accurate picture of what black life was like if you just picked up our newspaper. So much of the perception that people have then of a community is defined by the media. It's one of the major influencers out there. So that sort of stuff bothers me more than whether an individual reporter is black or white going into a particular neighborhood.
On a related note, you guys wrote back and forth about the sort of literature that you had read in school that you were asked to read. And Steve, you sort of thought back to your school career and realized you hadn't been made to read anything specifically that was African-American literature. I thought about, I think I might be a couple years behind you in school. I was asked to read those things, but they were very different. We didn't read Madame Bovary to learn about French culture. We read that as literature. We read The Bluest Eye with a very different intention. And I'm wondering if that is a, do we need to change that about the way we incorporate African-American literature into our canon in this country?
I don't know. That's hard for me to answer since I truly was, you know, schools integrated. I was finishing high school in the late 60s and graduated in 70. And so our schools were integrating at that point. And so it was happening in the classroom, but it wasn't happening in the curriculum yet. And so it's hard for me to, having not really, you know, read any of that literature and knowing the context it was presented in. But it sounds like it just sort of represents part of the learning curve that we're all going in mm-hmm. to, because I don't know where you went to school, but I'm going to bet that reading The Bluest Eye probably was an eye-opening experience for, you know, an insight into a culture that, that perhaps you didn't know that much about.
I went to an all-girls Catholic school in El Paso, Texas.
Okay. I'm certain that it was an insight into a culture you didn't have a lot of natural insight into. And so,
and Chris, I think we're beginning, I think the school systems, I mean, I think curricula across the country are beginning to address that lack of diversity in the reading material. So I think when I was growing up, I was trying to remember, I think we may have read A Raisin in the Sun, for example, but I certainly was exposed to maybe Langston Hughes and James Baldwin and, you know, and a few people here and there, but certainly not to the extent that you're exposed to other literature. I think that's important. It's important to that young black child or Hispanic child or Asian child who's sitting in the classroom, I think, to feel like they can identify with some of the authors of the materials that they're reading. There's certainly not a lack of material that's out there. So I think we begin to appreciate the extent to which that matters. I can see that how that wouldn't impact the Steve Blow, you know, because if you can kind of readily identify with the, you know, everything you're being asked to read and all the literature and it kind of jives with your sense of the world, I think you're quite comfortable with that. But if you're sitting there as I was in the 60s or 70s and you're reading history books and there's no reflection of any sort of accomplishment or achievements of blacks in any walks of life, I think that's quite disconcerting. And I think it raises a lot of questions and you want to know why. Why aren't there people like me who are doing great and wonderful things? You know, where are the black poets, you know?
James and, were laughing and I were laughing about this the other day. Poor George Washington Carver. Man, he had to carry the
weight.
He's
a box in every history textbook from second grade on up.
Exactly. I mean, even in my unenlightened era, James came along about 10 years later, but even in my unenlightened era and apparently still in his 10 years later, poor George Washington Carver was having to carry the weight for everybody. And it's laughable and sad.
But I got to say this, you know, I was thinking about the first time I became race conscious. I grew up in a small – Steve and I actually grew up in the same area of East Texas, but maybe 40 or 50 miles apart. But I really wasn't – I was one of eight kids in a working-class household. You know, my dad was a laborer, and my mom worked in the cafeteria, and she was a cook, and she worked in a chicken processing plant at different times, and we always had a hot meal on the table, and she took care of us. And we weren't even conscious of race. We had this sort of veneer of civility in my small town, but we couldn't go into the community center, for example. And I actually went to a segregated school up until I was in the third grade, which was like 1970. So my school district was one of three in East Texas that fought Brown versus Board of Topeka like tooth and nail for more than a decade and a half. But the first time I became really race conscious was when school was about to integrate, and my parents were so concerned about the consequences, the implications of that. And so they kind of got me worked up the first day of school to be on guard and not let anyone pick on me, basically. And that's the first time I actually became really fully aware that, hey, there's like two separate and different societies here, and they're about to merge. And I'm sort of caught up in the middle of that, you know. And think about sort of the weight of that if you're like a 9 or 10-year-old kid. And that really begins to change your the way you see the world when that impression is made upon you at that age.
1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Number. James Ragland and Steve Blow are here. Both are columnists for the Dallas Morning News who recently completed a series called Talking Race. Let's speak to Angela in Dallas. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay. My question is, I just relocated from Cleveland, Ohio. Got into Dallas, love the community, but it's very curious and interesting to me because even in Cleveland, we certainly had segregated neighborhoods in some areas, but all walks of life kind of congregated back and forth through everyday life, whereas here it's so distinct, it seems, the division between races and the blacks in south of the city and the whites up north, it's just so overt, and it was very shocking to me, and I thought maybe they could comment on this, and is there any movement or is there any efforts to modify and integrate better?
Angela, I don't know what neighborhood you live in, but I will tell you there are parts of Dallas and our suburbs that are, you know, rapidly becoming very integrated. I live out on the eastern edge of the county, and you know, the Garland, Mesquite, that area out there is you know, really highly integrated, and. But I guess from a historical perspective, you have moved to the South, And so I suspect we're overcoming a more deeply entrenched segregation that was probably in place a lot longer and a lot stronger than where you grew up. But I'm certain there are places that remain, pretty lily white and pretty segregated. But I'm heartened by the extent to which this burgeoning, tremendously successful black middle class that gets so overlooked, to the extent to which they are, moving into, really every corner of the city.
I tend to agree with that. I think D Magazine did a piece maybe a year ago in which they examined the problem you're talking about, and there is a lot of resegregation that's taking place. I think it's largely driven, again, by economics more than anything else. I think a lot of families, black and white alike, begin to move out of the city in search of more bang for their buck, better schools, and so forth. But I do think there's a racial component to that, and I hope that we are beginning to sort of see a shift there. I live in Lake Highlands, as Steve pointed. I have a house there. I'm moving back to Lake Highlands. I've lived there for years, and it's a fairly well integrated community too. I've certainly done my part. I mean, I've lived in University Park for a while, and I've tried to go.
You've
into,
done your part to integrate neighborhoods.
integrate neighborhoods, but that's a serious issue. And I think that's where real change occurs when we begin to stop running from each other, and people begin to kind of live in integrated neighborhoods, and their kids go to the same school. That's where real change is going to occur, I think.
One of the things, I guess you guys had a discussion about it. You talked about so-called black names, which are, more common among African-Americans, and the effect that they can have when someone is, applying for a job or trying to get a loan or different things. Can you sort of recap that conversation for us just a little bit?
Yeah, part of that was our desire to go back kind of the starting place for this, was to bring things out and put them on the table for discussion that I think a lot of whites and blacks don't feel easy talking about. So we really were sort of looking for, electric topics with the idea of showing that they can be discussed in good humor and seriously, but friendly. That was really our overarching goal for this whole project. And so that was one where I think a lot of white folks are certainly take note and think about it, maybe talk about it among themselves, but would never go there with a black friend. So that was the idea of putting that one on the table. And yeah, I just think for a lot of white folks, it's perplexing. There's such a cultural difference there. Whites tend to look for the same 10 names, that's going to convey
Ashley,
the most.
Ashley, Emily, Michael,
exactly,
Jacob.
Yeah, exactly. Go to any first grade and it's going to be, Ashley M, Ashley W, Ashley K, because, the white folks are so within their little boundaries of looking for these power names, these names that are going to convey strength and so forth. And it's just interesting to me that so many in the black culture go the other direction, and they are absolutely looking for a name that has never, ever been uttered by any human tongue before, no matter how many apostrophes it takes to put in there. And so I threw that one out for discussion with James. I think to a large extent, this one, again, comes down to a matter of class, not race. That, I don't see middle-class professional black couples giving their children exotic names. I think poor folks tend to do that, and to me, I'm concerned about that because I think it tends to become a reinforcing stereotype that kid's going to face a tough, tougher opportunities.
Well, and I have to wonder too if kids don't, if there were, I'm going to offend someone out there, but if you saw a job application a name like Raylene or Cletus, if you'd make an assumption about the sort of class in which that person was
raised.
Well,
exactly. That's a great point among whites. Yeah, I mean, if you see the name Billy Bob, if you say Billy Bob Blow on a invitation on a application, yeah, you're going to jump to some conclusions. Names do convey things.
I don't know if that's a uniquely black thing or not, and I certainly understand Steve's point because there have been a number of studies done that have shown if you hold all things constant on a job application, but you have sort of these codes there that might indicate that a person may be black or maybe Arab for that matter, that there are certain biases that are there and certain discrimination that takes place. It's harder for Lakeisha or some of the more creative names that Steve threw out at me to get that job interview. But my question becomes this. I think we certainly could ask people to be a little more circumspect in naming their kids, but I also think it gets down to us dealing with our own biases about that. What difference does it make whether I'm James or Jamil or whatever, that that you want to judge people by the content of their characters, not the bizarre combination of characters in their name? That's the part that kind of gives me pause. So
You're right.
You know, there was a tradition that started probably about 4 or 5 decades ago. You know, we went through this Black Power movement, and people started denouncing sort of white slave names and started coming up with creative names. And it's sort of a tradition that we've gotten carried away with in some ways. And there are names that I can't even pronounce. So to that end, I think Steve is right. But that's one of the least concerns I have. But I do think it pretends or can create problems for people in terms of the workforce and society at large, because they are making assumptions about you based on your name.
1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's go next to Oak Cliff and speak to Mike. Hey, Mike.
Hi there.
Hi.
Appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
First thing, I want to thank the two gentlemen for doing this. I think there's a need for more of this, and it's a subject that's so sensitive that people are afraid to tackle. So kudos to both of them for doing so. Just briefly, a little background. I was born in 1961 and came of age here in Dallas, and I can remember sitting at the dinner table and having long arguments with my folks during the early part of the 1970s about race and all the problems that were happening here, and I was the lone voice on a fairly large Catholic family, always supporting the rights of the African Americans. When I finally got a little bit older and I took the first opportunity to leave home, I actually moved to Oak Cliff, much to my folks' dismay, but I wanted a more mixed cultural atmosphere, and I was glad I did. But as time has gone on, I've become more and more frustrated because, as it happens, I also happen to be a gay man, and where I saw myself standing up for the African-American community, they have not in any way, shape, or form done the same back. In so many cases, a large majority, in fact, they've kind of been a large obstacle. And I know that both Steve and James have written about this in the past, and James has alluded to the deeply held religious expression or beliefs of the African-American community. But of course,
we're about to take a break, Mike. Can you wrap up, and then we'll get your answer after the break? About 10 seconds?
I'll wrap up and say that... since that was the same excuse used against the black folks, why is that a valid excuse against gay folks?
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Mike. We'll be back in just a moment. You can join us at 800-933-5372. You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are columnists Steve Blow and James Ragland of the Dallas Morning News. We're discussing their series Talking Race, which you can read online at dallasnews.com. Before the break, the caller had asked about the gay and lesbian movement and why there's not more support of that from the African-American community.
You know, there are some African-American leaders and plenty in the African-American community who support gay and lesbian rights, but I think what Mike has to understand is there are a couple of things that are taking place. There are some African-American leaders who have long resented the fact that so many sort of subgroups, if you will, women to some extent, gay and lesbian is another example, were sort of piggybacking on the civil rights movement. And they felt like that the movement was beginning to take a different turn before blacks had really kind of gained sort of the full access to society themselves. So they felt like the movement was being co-opted. But beyond that, Mike, there's also just, I think, the issue of sort of, you know, the gay and lesbian movement. There are some that has some religious implications as well. And I think there are quite a few people in the black community who kind of part ways for moral or religious reasons that don't necessarily buy into the gay and lesbian agenda. So it's a little bit more complicated than just simply saying, you know, blacks aren't supporting gay and lesbian rights. I think black folks support human rights, but I think they have some moral issues with sort of the gay and lesbian movements that they're still struggling with.
But James, if we're going to have a frank discussion, let's also be willing to put it on the table that prejudice is something that exists among all human beings, including in the black community. And I think that's something that whites sometimes bristle at, is that, you know, sort of the white demon aspect that only whites have this problem. And the truth is that, you know, we all as humans have prejudice issues. You know, in the black community, there's, you know, you don't hear it talked about very much, but prejudice over skin tone. And again, things that get talked about within the black community, but I think it's time to sort of, you know, bring those things out for wider discussions. I think it'd be healthy for all of us.
Steve, of the things that you wrote that you tried to be as frank as possible with, what felt the riskiest to you?
Oh, gosh, let's see. Probably in that open letter, I really kind of, where I said... that especially to young disenfranchised blacks, I said, I don't need to give advice to this burgeoning black middle class that's doing just great without my advice. But to the underclass that is a term that's often used, I just wanted them to consider the notion that there may be some white people that you don't know that are so rooting for you out there that contrary to this notion that may have been put in your head that, you know, white folks are out to get you, that you just have no idea how many people of goodwill that are out there urging you, you know, rooting for you and looking to give you, you know, a chance to root you on, you know, you have to earn it, but that are on your side. Companies that want to hire you and schools that want to enroll you, that kind of thing. And on the flip side of that, I want you to consider the possibility that some of those blacks who are closest to you, because of human nature, may be working unconsciously or consciously to undermine your success, and that they're going to pull you down in ways that will just, you know, stymie you before you ever really get started. And that, you know, that, like, who am I to say that to a black kid? But it felt real, and if we're going to be real and say things, that's what I wanted to say.
Did it feel risky to you because you thought it might come across as sort of paternalistic and that you would be misinterpreted and people would say, oh, Steve Blow is a racist. He writes all this, but he's a racist.
Well, yeah, exactly. They'd just be taken the wrong way that, you know, it's this patronizing white guy that's, you know, what does he know about me? And, you know, who is he to talk about my black friends and what they want for me, that sort of thing. But, again, our exercise here was about putting our feelings and our impressions out there. And, you know, you open yourself up for criticism, but that's what we need to, you know, we need to have this give and take. We need to have the courage to find, you know, not just pounce on the first black person you see and try to go off into these deep discussions. But if they're black, you know, if you have a coworker that you've really established a relationship with, I think it's become so clear to me that people are just afraid to go there, black and white. But if you've built a relationship with somebody, or you just sense that there's an openness there to have a real conversation about this, I think the thing we need to do is, you know, have the courage to do it. If you quickly find out that that the emotions are too strong and that it just there's no room for a conversation, then back off because it's not going to work in every case. But James and I have just, partly because of our backgrounds and similarities, I guess, and we're both a couple of pretty moderate middle of the road, common sense kind of guys, we've just always been able to have these very natural conversations in our cubicles in the newsroom. And so the whole idea of the series was to sort of move that conversation out into print. And
I think sometimes if we could put everybody in a cubicle next to someone who's not exactly like them, the
world
might be a better place.
Exactly.
James, what for you was toughest to write?
You know, for me, it was really sort of the overall project. My biggest concern is that, because I get this a lot as a black columnist who often writes about issues that affect the black community, and I try to provide some insight into that. And you would think that our readership, for the most part, would appreciate the insight you might bring in terms of why the black community, for example, might interpret an event differently than the white community here. But often when I write about it that way, I'm accused of being sort of an apologist for the black community or making excuses for problems in the black community, which I'm not. So for me, I think people think I'm more race conscious than I am. And in my personal life, I'm just not. But so I'm a journalist. So I look at things critically, but I try to look at them in a constructive way. I want our society to move forward. I want Dallas to move forward. I want us to have better race relations. I don't wake up in the morning and say, I wonder what white folks are up to today or what black folks are up to today. I get up and start my day like everybody else. I have, you know, I have cereal in the morning and I kiss my wife and I hug my daughter and I pet my dog and I get on about my day. And so I just don't see the world that way. And I really regret that people think sometimes because I look at issues and try to challenge society to be better and to approach things a slightly different way, that can be misconstrued. That's one of my biggest concerns anytime we write about these issues. Steve had mentioned this. I don't mind. I happen to be married to a person who's of the opposite race. And I think we learn a lot from each other. I told Steve when I was growing up, and I feel so comfortable talking with him, I realized early on, for example, when I began to travel and leave my small town in East Texas and go about, I realized that I had much more in common with the people in my small town, regardless of whether they were black or white, male or female, than I did with some kid who grew up in Oak Cliff or South Dallas or in Harlem, for that matter. One of my best friends, who's a teacher down in Hill College now, his name is, you know, JP. He was sort of a chubby white kid It reminds me of sort of the old fatty and skinny TV program. That's sort of what we look like. But JP and I have much more in common than some of the friends I had who may have been black, only because we grew up in the same small town. We grew up in the same environment. We had the same interest, you know. So we have to look at things a little bit different sometimes beyond just sort of the black and white of it.
Some people jumped on me for using the term colorblind, and I kind of made a joking reference that said, you know, James, sometimes I forget you're black. And some people said, oh, let's get real. This, you know, we live in a race-conscious society. You can never get that way. But the truth is, I think we can. You know, yeah, on some level you're gonna always know. But I guarantee Shannon does not get up and say, good morning, my black husband. You know, she sees James as her, you know, her husband, and I see James as my friend and my coworker. While, you know, I understand the point they're trying to make, that let's respect color. Sure, I love ethnicities. I'm married to my wife's of Italian heritage, and I love, you know, the richness of life that brings. And
you don't say good morning, my Italian bride?
Yeah, I don't say good morning, my olive-skinned, you know, bride. No, I don't say that. In theory, think about it. So on the one level, we can enjoy it, celebrate it, but I think it really is possible to just begin to relate to each other as human beings and you know, put so much of this behind us.
Let me ask you about this, though. Okay, so James, you mentioned, and Steve, you sort of agree that we have different ways that we draw circles around ourselves and our groups of people. So in other words,
right. We
may relate really well to people in the middle class, and we also may relate really well to people who grew up in the same faith or people who grew up in the same city or whatever. Why is the circle we draw around race so often so much more obvious and so much darker, maybe, than the circle we draw around other affinity groups in our lives?
You know, I think I was talking earlier about sort of that baggage. I mean, you look at the black experiencer, for example. I think black culture is so marginalized in the mainstream media that all we hear about are the pathologies. And so if you're reading about, you know, just suspects all the time, and you don't read about, you know, folks who are accomplishing things, then your view of what the black experience is like is pretty skewed, right? And so you only talk about black life and black culture in one way, and it's much more diverse and it's much richer than that. I'm deeply concerned, for example, about the way we're talking about Latinos and Hispanics in the Dallas-Fort Worth area now. When I hear people talking about Latinos, they seem to reduce the whole Latino experience to just illegal immigrants, you know, that everybody they come in contact with is somebody who's newly arrived here and don't share in the American dream, don't have a sense of history. And the fabric of the Hispanic community is much broader and richer than the debate has been reduced to by some politicians and opportunists. So that's what concerns me.
1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded. Number.
Let's go next to Felix in Fort Worth. Hi, Felix.
Yes. I wanted to tell Mr. Steve Blow, I want to give him a perspective from an African-American delivery driver that delivers every day different businesses. And to my surprise, positively, I've noticed the younger white generation of young people are really pushing Obama. And I guess that's a good thing, because could it be that the younger generation, the racial issues decline as each generation, you know, progresses in the future? And I just want to hang up.
Thanks very much for your call. It's a great point.
Absolutely. Felix, times do change. I mean, we need to, you know, at the same time we're working on the problems, let's, you know, celebrate the fact that times do change. Chris, going back to this thing of how you know, vividly that racial line is drawn. You know, we don't have to look back in history very long to see where Irish and Italian communities that existed side by side in some communities had very dark, vivid lines drawn. And, you know, boy, interaction between the young people of those two communities could bring all kinds of problems. And, time does bring healing. And I think it's happening here. I'm so happy to hear Felix talk about that he encounters that goodwill that I'm talking about.
We've made so much progress. We were talking about my wife earlier, and what's interesting about her is that she's a daughter of a foreign service officer, and she was actually born in Afghanistan. So it's interesting that she spent her formative years in other countries where she really was a minority. So she came here, and her views on race are really interesting. So it was even sort of a jolting to her to see sort of the black-white relation and how bizarre it was, and like particularly in small town, like out in an area where we live called in Paris, where we have a place, and she could see sort of the dividing lines there. They were much sharper than she, and she just couldn't understand that. So, so there's something there that when fresh eyes or outside eyes can take note of it, you know, there's still something there. But I do think we're making progress. I want to tell you real quickly about, we were talking about books that we've read and things that sort of shaped our impressions on the opposite race. And I mentioned that one of my favorite was, and it's one that my wife just recently read. It's called The Color of Water. And it's by James McBride, who happens to be, his father was African-American, and his mother was white. She's actually Orthodox Jew. And I love one of the exchanges that they were having when he was young, and he was asking his mom, you know, what color Jesus was, and asking whether Jesus was white. And she said that, you know, Jesus is not white, not black, and Jesus is the color of water. And hence the name of the book, The Color of Water. I do think we're moving, hopefully, toward that point where we begin to look at each other and we just see each other as a color of water, and we begin to kind of judge each other based on the content of our character, not by the by our complexion.
Is there any point in trying to transcend race entirely? Should we, you know, this word colorblind comes up, and it's almost a joke. Should we strive for a world where we don't notice what differences exist?
I don't think so.
You know, I simply see race and ethnicity and the color of your skin as just another physical trait or characteristic of who you are. I think we're all the better for that diversity. I think we should have embraced that rather than making sort of harsh judgments about it. So I don't think that ethnicity and race in and of itself is the problem. The problem becomes what we begin to associate with that. That's why it's very important how we begin to sort of cast or portray certain ethnic groups. You know, we can't build these stereotypes in our head.
Yeah, goodness knows, I would never want to just sort of, you know, wash all that away. As I said earlier, I love the richness of life and all our different experiences and backgrounds and so forth. to quote the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, different is not deficient. And that may be the one lasting quote from him, you know.
I did not think you'd end, Steve Blow, with a quote from Jeremiah Wright.
I'm stunned.
You're surprising every time. Steve Blow and James Ragland both are columnists for the Dallas Morning News. Their four-part series, Talking Race, ran this month and remains available online at dallasnews.com. Guys, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It was fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.